I wouldn't do. That boy means the world to me.
This is the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom show, The Wake Up Call, on WCOM-LP, Chapel Hill and Carrboro, 103.5. Back with you in a moment.
Sell my soul if Jimmy didn't have to go. I went from the army to the army reserves. There's nothing that moves I can't fix. I didn't think much about it, just a weekend warrior. Then I turned 36, and they called me in, and they shipped me out. I'm thinking now I could have said no, but I whispered to Kathy we would finish it early, so Jimmy didn't have to go. 'Cause if Jimmy didn't have to go, there's nothing I wouldn't do. That boy means the world to me. He ought to mean the world to you. I don't know why we throw lives away and come home with nothing to show. I only know I would sell my soul if Jimmy didn't have to go. They said it wouldn't come to hand to hand, though the border's just a mile away. Well, the enemy surprised us from behind. They were running back the other way. Guess they were looking for a place to hide.
This is the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom show, The Wake Up Call. We are here at WCOM-LP, Chapel Hill and Carrboro. And today we have the Chief of Police of Chapel Hill. He's going to be on the air with us and answer some questions. Hopefully everyone that we have, but not necessarily. And I'm Dick Paddock. Co-host. Lori Hoyt is across from me, a co-host, and we have a guest host today, Miriam Thompson, and of course our trusty camera operator, Emily O'Hare. So we're all here, and we'd like to say that we're here every Wednesday afternoon, barring terrible weather like we had last week.
Yes, last week we had to play one of our oldest shows. The tornado decided to interfere right at the time we like to get started here. So,
right. So
we decided not to risk limb and life for the radio show. Sorry about that, folks.
And the well-being of our police chief.
And well, yes.
I'm sure that one of the
and he had a few busy things he had to do.
You were probably right in the middle of it.
He
that
was.
Point.
Yeah.
And he had a few things a bit more urgent than our show to answer for. Something else we'd like you to know is that in addition to being here on Wednesdays from 5 to 6, our show is also seen at 10 p.m. on the People's Channel, 10 p.m. on Thursdays.
On Thursdays,
while we're here on Wednesday at 5 p.m. from 5 to 6.
Yeah.
So we want to make sure to get that in. And also to let you know that what you hear are not any views that belong to the station or the management of the station, but those of us who are expressing them here as we talk to the chief and express our own opinions. So with that, let's
get started.
Move forward.
Yeah, I just want to, I'm delighted to be here. Glad we're not having any tornadoes today. It's a beautiful, bright, sunny day in downtown Carrboro. And we're in this delightful studio. They've taken some of the paper down, so we're all open on all sides. So it's just wonderful, the sky views. And we have the Chief of Police, as Dick said, Chris Blue, with us. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me. And yes, it is a beautiful day compared to last week when we were very concerned about weather and I think wisely decided to put this off a week.
It might be helpful, Lori and Chris, if you could start out by giving us your background, how long you've been in the police department, how long you've been the chief of police.
Sure. So I've been in Chapel Hill most of my life. I graduated from Chapel Hill High School and then graduated from UNC pretty close to 4 years later, with actually a degree in radio, television, motion pictures production. I was in the RTVMP department, which has actually now been rolled into the journalism school. In any case, after a few years after graduating from college, I got hired by the Chapel Hill Police Department. That was 1997. And so coming up on my 19-year anniversary with the town of Chapel Hill, and I've been chief for a little over 5 years now.
We thought we'd structure the discussion, the interview, the conversation, I think that's better, the conversation around three or four different areas. One, we wanted to start in the schools because people are really concerned about the role of the SROs in the rule, the role of security, the excessive use in the past of discipline practices and the inappropriate use of SROs to really do what could be done by, should be done by the schools and more basic appropriate educational interventions. So if you could talk about that, the training, the new memorandum of understanding that has been voted on by the Board of Education. And then we thought the next area, which I'll get to after the schools, is really police in the community and your whole concept of community policing.
Sure. Well, I'll just talk generally about school resource officers and welcome any follow-up questions you have, and then I'll dive into this memorandum of understanding that Chapel Hill Carrboro City Schools and both the Carrboro and Chapel Hill Police Departments have entered into that provides some guidelines and framework around the role of the SRO in the schools. So in all of the middle schools and high schools in our district, either Carrboro or Chapel Hill will supply a school resource officer to staff those buildings. And that program's been in place for many years, maybe 20 years or more in our system. And I think it's a very successful program, but it's one that I think all participants would agree has been treated a little differently from school to school. The role of the SRO has been oftentimes influenced by the needs of that particular school or the interests of that school administration and so on. And that's not a knock on anybody, but it's just an observation I think everyone has that there's an opportunity for a little more consistency from school to school. So within that spirit, a couple of years ago, some interested community members brought that idea to the school system and to the local police departments. Maybe some people in this room participated in that effort.
Yeah.
And it's a really good idea, and I am pleased to say that the officers and the school administrators and officials with the school system and community members together, I think, have ultimately arrived at a guiding document that the school board adopted a few months ago that addresses some of those inconsistencies that we've talked about. Things like some standardization of the kinds of training that officers receive. Now, I will tell you that SROs receive a lot of training. That's always been the case. This document doesn't change that necessarily, but it does require it. And that's good. It puts some parameters around that. I think maybe the most meaningful elements of the agreement, though, have to deal with the philosophy behind the school resource officer and the school resource officer's application. Because as I've talked to people in the community about the usefulness of having officers in schools, rarely am I talking about officers doing enforcement. That does happen sometimes, but what I think we all say is those officers there to provide security, to be excellent role models, to be mentors, to seize opportunities for positive contacts. And if you think about it, in a high school where there are thousands of kids, and those officers are interacting all day long, literally there's opportunity for thousands of positive contacts every single day. That's a big deal. That's great for lots of reasons that I think we all can agree with. The challenge, I think, over the years has been that one school might involve an officer in a disciplinary proceeding differently than another might. This document brings some clarity to that officer's role in a way that I think makes everybody understand a little bit better. And, in fact, the document specifically talks about violations of criminal law might be the officer's business. violation of school policy and disciplinary kinds of things are not the officer's business. Nobody's more excited about that than those SROs, I can tell you, because they understand their role better than maybe any of us do. So that agreement brings some clarity to that and provides some guidelines about when an officer will or will not be brought into a situation. It also talks about just some good reminders in the document about notification and about the appropriateness of an officer becoming involved in a situation and what he or she should do when that happens. And what I mean by that is there's specific language in the document that says, if at all possible, and unless there's an emergent situation, an officer should notify school staff and school administrative folks before they take any kind of enforcement action anyway. That makes good sense, right? And that also provides an opportunity for all of the persons of authority to have the same information at the same time and be acting in a way that where the communication is clear.
There is a proviso that if it's an emergency or if there's a whatever, a gun battle or something, where there's criminal.
Right. Okay. I think that clarity, the acknowledgement that obviously officers, hopefully very infrequently, have to take some immediate action is there. But the fact of the matter is for daily kinds of enforcement, there's probably time to slow down and involve some school staff. And I will tell you, I think the agreement was adopted by the school system in November or December, I don't remember which, but officers are delighted. We've been operating off of this document now. I would say in practice we have for a long time, but I would say officially now for a few months. I've seen nothing but positive come from that. So we're really excited about that.
Whose responsibility is it if there is an enforcement action? The school's been notified, and there's obviously other interventions that they would work out together. Who's responsible for notifying the parents or the guardians?
Well, the document does speak to the requirement that a notification happen, and if an officer takes some action, then the expectation is the officer is going to either make that contact or see to it that school officials make that contact. I'm glad you made that point because that is something I wanted to mention, too. That's one of those things that you would expect would automatically happen, but we know sometimes it hasn't happened. The officer thought school's doing it or vice versa, so this document makes clear that the officer will either make the contact or cause that contact to happen, and that's a good accountability.
Did you want to ask more about the training and certainly the interview?
Well, yeah, that was something that came up when we were working
process.
With the schools, was that the schools pay part at least of the salary, and when we asked, are they part of the interviewing process, they were a little unclear about that. So we felt that was really important because, you know, we're dealing with young people and we're dealing with education and we're dealing with particularly the older kids, adolescent psychology, which is a whole field of study by itself, and it's really important to know how to interact. And so I think that's now that the schools are part of that interviewing process so they can kind of gauge the level of training in terms of, education and psychology that the officers have.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, so for as many years as I can remember, whenever we were selecting a new school resource officer, and I'm sure this is true in Carrboro, and I know it is in Chapel Hill, we've involved school officials in the selection and interview process.
Yeah.
Anyway, I don't think, though, prior to this MOU being put in place, that was required by anybody. Mm-hmm. It was a practice that we followed.
Mm-hmm.
But having that captured in the MOU is also a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact of the matter is, it's been my experience, it really takes a special officer to do this job.
Mm-hmm.
We generally don't see young officers wanting to do the work of a school resource officer. We see veteran officers who see the school resource opportunity as a real positive opportunity to interact with young people. who also like the schedule. It's a pretty good work schedule, too. And so it's been my experience that we generally get veteran officers who want to do it for the right reason anyway. So they self-select in that regard. But it is certainly useful to have both police officials participate in the selection process, because ultimately these folks are responsible to us, mm-hmm. but also the school officials from the school where the officer is going to be working, because mm-hmm. as a practical matter, that officer is interacting with that school staff mm-hmm. really much more than they're interacting with me or any of my police supervisors. Mm-hmm. So it's important that everyone feel good about the selection, that they're accepted by the school officials who will be interacting on a daily basis. And so far, this worked really well. I will also say, and the MOU talks about this, some guidelines, or at least some guidance around removing an officer if that were not the right fit. That happens infrequently, although the point I made earlier about you really need to want to do this. This is a unique job. We've had an officer or two in the time that I have been working in Chapel Hill who thought, I really want to do this job. And they would get into the school setting and they would say, wait, this is not what I thought. And then they opt out. So that's good, too. And this MOU just kind of formalizes how that might happen.
Yeah.
And I've been real pleased with the honesty of those who have said, this is not for me after all, and wisely have removed themselves.
Absolutely.
I have a two-part. One, if you can expand a little bit on what kind of training the SROs get. What is the part of the training that helps them collaborate with staff, which was one of our real concerns? You know, they were often being used to engage students when it would have been more appropriate for school personnel. So now I want to take the SS part of that. I want to take the SRO's point of view. Who does the SRO let know when they think the school intervention schemes are really not being put into practice and instead more aggressive discipline procedures are used by the school, either using the SRO or their own practice? So if, as you said, their security, their mentors, their role models, what role do they play when they see the student might be not being treated fairly or disproportionately disciplined?
Well,
or inappropriately disciplined.
Yeah, so I think it's true in really every school in our system. The SROs are part of the school staff in many ways. So they certainly participate in ongoing staff training and staff discussions about student behavior and school trends that they're finding. They also, while they spend their day in the school, they do have a police supervisor who is directly responsible for them. And right now that's one of our sergeants, and he interacts with the SROs probably on a daily basis, but if not, certainly a few times a week. And I don't think we've encountered a situation yet, particularly since the MOU's been in place, where an officer had concerns about an action. I haven't been aware of that at all. But I do believe that the mechanism is there to bring that to police officials. And we would address it with the school system. I'm hoping that never happens. But I also know that the SROs and school staff, and I'm talking about administrative staff, every quarter meet. All of the SROs from all of the schools, as well as some school system staff. And they talk about training opportunities. They talk about trends they might have identified. They will debrief situations that might have happened that others might benefit from hearing about. So I think the communication is really good. It's really strong. My sense is that, as I said at the outset of our discussion, this MOU provides clarity and comfort for all parties, I think. So things are going really well.
I just want to maybe enforce, and I'm glad there haven't been instances, yeah. but I think it's really helpful when the supervisor meets with the SROs yeah. a couple of times a week just to find out how these practices are really in effect. How do they feel about the way yeah. in which the students that, as you say, they mentor and support are having opportunity in the school or being treated, you know, fairly and wisely and sensitively? Because it isn't just the student, it's also staff. We always see trouble in the school through the lens of what is the student doing, but often it is corrective measures that need to be taken with staff.
And I guess part of those of us who've been working with the schools, you know, the whole larger issue is the school-to-prison pipeline that we're deeply concerned about. And part of that is, you know, an understanding of cultural diversity, what might seem disrespectful to either some SROs or also to some school staff may not, in the culture this kid is from, may not be meant disrespectfully, and that's something we're working with the schools on, that schools have a lot of work to do in that regard, and that's what also we're concerned about with the SROs, that training include that kind of cultural understanding.
I also want to say, by the way, it's not just the culture the student comes from. Peer culture is very vibrant in the schools, and often kids learn from each other. Yeah. And that behavior, as Lori said much earlier, is part of the whole psychology that we need to be sensitive to in this, you know, incredible period of youth development, meaning teenage years.
Yeah.
I think just going to the point about the supervisors checking, my guess is that the sergeant who supervises our SROs, I don't know whether he's listening right now or not, but he will watch this or listen to this at some point, and he'll say, "Chief, I check in a lot more than twice a week," and I'll probably be corrected by him for that. So I'll go ahead and acknowledge that right now, that he'll probably correct me. I will say that the officers I think they understand the young people probably better than we give them credit for, because they're among them every day, all day. And I can't say enough about the officers who do opt into the school environment. They're going for the right reasons.
Yeah,
that's been my experience. So their interest in helping these young folks be successful is genuine. I see it time and time again. In fact, I'll tell a story, and it's an old story, but I think I don't think anybody working within the system right now will be affected by this. But I remember a school resource officer some years ago when I used to supervise them, directly supervise them, call me at home one night and saying that some folks in the court system, this is many years ago now, called him and expressed concern that he didn't charge a student with something more serious than what he had actually charged a student with. So in other words, he had a low-level offense that the officer did petition a kid to juvenile court, and heard from the court that it should have been a more serious charge. And the officer was couldn't believe that call had come in and wanted me to call the court officials and talk to them about that. And by the way, I say that with all due respect to court officials. And it's an isolated case in my experience. But I think it illustrates the point. What I'm trying to say is the SROs are there for the right reason.
Yeah.
They're not interested in criminalizing kids. That doesn't mean that we don't acknowledge the school-to-prison pipeline discussion. We do. Mm-hmm. I do believe that the clarity of the police officer's role is directly responsive to the concerns around the school-to-prison pipeline. Not a perfect solution. It is one solution that I think is very effective and is in place right now.
I want to pick up on the characterization of the SROs that you've repeated, that they really want to be in the schools, that they want to be working with students, and I want to really take that for granted for the purpose of this conversation. In that capacity and with that role and with that vision, it's even more important for them to have this conversation with the supervisor, not so much to identify necessarily the school, but somehow that conversation that they think things might be better resolved by school personnel.
Mm-hmm.
There should be a conversation either with the district superintendent. So I don't know if those conversations take place, but I think if there's any concern, SRO should be encouraged to identify them, to have it brought out in staff meetings where they should feel comfortable. They're not going to be penalized. They're not going to have their contract not renewed. That is a fundamental part of their role in that school with staff. As they listen to staff, and staff informs their work, so their work informs staff, all on behalf of the kids, all in making the difficult teenage years very helpful. And remember, kids are coming into middle school and high school with a lot of difficulties and concerns and, you know, could be treated better and educated better in the earlier grades. So here all of a sudden they're teenager carrying a lot of baggage that they might have inherited from practices in the school. So I think that conversation back and forth is really very important.
I agree.
Yeah, we need to take a station break now, and we're almost halfway through the show, and so we better move on to the next topic. But first, we'll go with the station break here, which is for me to say that this is WCOM LP, Chapel Hill and Carrboro, 103.5 on your FM dial, and also available on your cable box. Time Warner Cable is channel 8. In Carrboro, it's channel 4 on your cable.
I think AT&T, it's 99.
Yeah, you have to play games with it when you go on AT&T because you have to work your way down through a menu.
And did you talk about it, if you're having static that you can stream us live?
No, I hadn't mentioned that, but that's good thing to bring up right now.
Yeah,
if you're having problems, you can stream us over your computer by going to the station's website, which is wcomfm.org, and click on Listen Live.
Because we are very low power.
Yes.
We're wonderful, but we are very low power.
Right. One strong light bulb's worth of energy.
That's why we always...
100-watt station, yes.
That's why Dick always, and we will request, and we advise Chief Lou that we will be making CDs of this broadcast. So if people want to order them, how do they do that? And we'll make a copy available to the police chief.
Yeah. We should
and the town council.
Yeah, I think we may want to just provide a supply to the chief and let him dole them out as they demand.
And how would people who are our listeners and viewers order the CD?
It's pretty straightforward. You can, if you're going to drop by the police station and pick one up, or you can email me. REPADD7@icloud.com, and if you do that, I'll make a copy of the CD and send it to you.
Do we also put it on our website?
Yeah, it'll probably take a little while to get there, but there is a radio archive on the WILPF website, which is WILPF.org. And you can find it there and listen to it. It's probably not too terribly convenient for you to download it, but you can, I assume, download it onto your own computer for listening to it at your leisure, or you can just stream it from the website.
Or they can email you at?
Email me at REPADD7@icloud.com.
Okay.
And I will endeavor to get the thing to you forthwith.
Do we have any particular announcements? One of the things I guess we could say is that the NAACP meets the first Saturday of the month, which will be this Saturday from 1 to 3 or 1 to 2:30 at the Rogers Road Community Center, and the public is invited. We encourage you to come and find out what the NAACP is doing and what the issues are.
And I will also remind you that tomorrow is the first day of early voting.
You bet.
Yes.
You do need to bring an ID if you... And find it at all possible to bring an ID, but you can, at least for the time being, during this early voting period, you can register and vote at the same on the same trip.
But don't wait till election day. That's just right. During the early voting,
right.
you can do
right.
both.
And it's one stop voting.
Mm-hmm. One stop voting, and mm-hmm. you can also. What was I going to say? It went away. It must not have been very important.
Well, I also should remind people not only the early voting, but it's March 3rd through March 12th. It's 10 to 7 weekday weekdays and from 9 to 1 on Saturday. Many people are familiar, but it will be at the Carborough Town Hall, it will be at the Seymour Center, and it will be at Chapel of the Cross.
Yes.
And there is a
And it will not be on Sunday. It'll be Monday
will be
through
no
Friday.
No Sunday early voting. And I do want to give one telephone number, because if people have any difficulty voting, Democracy North Carolina, Democracy NC, which is a wonderful operation that has been really fighting for access to voting together with the NAA.
And we're going to have somebody from Democracy North Carolina on next week, Quentin Harper.
Their number is for their election hotline is 888-687-8683. That's 888-687-8683. And I have the Board of Elections number, but I think that 888-687-8683 is fine. But again, 10 to 7.
So make sure you vote, because it's very exciting. And
there are particularly, don't miss, very important county commissioner
yes.
elections and some really very important
And this
candidates.
Week, Sandy has got its recommendations. You may not agree with them, but it tells you a little bit about each of the candidates and why they're supporting who they are, but they also mention the others. So it's a very informative issue, the Indy, this week, so just came out this today. So you might want to know that. And I think that's it for announcements.
Just one other short little announcement, and that is at the top of the hour, Chris Fitzsimons, excuse me, with North Carolina Policy Watch.
Yes.
Will be on the air with his weekly commentary.
Yes. Okay, and now back to our guest is the Chief of Police of Chapel Hill, Chris Blue. We're delighted to have him here. He's a very busy person, and we're glad he's here. And Emily, you wanted to get in a word here?
I do. I wanted to ask a question. Yeah, we're talking about SROs, but I'm wondering what is the job of the SRO? When they go into the school, what exactly do they do? What's their assignment? And maybe also, how does that vary from elementary, middle, and high school?
There's no elementary, in Chapel Hill Carborough.
Oh, okay.
No SROs in elementary.
Okay.
Only in middle and senior.
She teaches in Durham. School. Yeah.
I didn't know they had elementary. Wow.
So the officer's day starts early. They start arriving before the students do, and actually I think it's true in just about every site. They try to be visible when kids are being dropped off, when buses are dropped off. In some of our locations where we have lots of traffic going in and out of the schools, they actually, the first part of their day is spent directing traffic in and out of the kiss and go lane. And that consumes a lot of their time, and the way some of the schools are situated, that's an important function for them to hold. And then throughout the day, they are doing a variety of things. They're present and visible in the hallways between classes. Same during lunch and other kind of school activities. So when there's opportunities for them to be out and be seen and engaged, they do that. Throughout the day, they may be responding to a 911 call at the school. Generally, those turn out to be unfounded, but in a building with lots of phones, we get lots of erroneous 911 calls, and that happens in our schools too. So they're following up on police calls for service that might actually originate in a school setting, and again, thankfully, most of the time, those are pretty benign. They may be called to a situation where a student wants to share information with an officer, or has a need for some kind of intervention, whatever that might mean. So really they're available to respond as a police officer would in any other setting. The difference is they're also throughout the day oftentimes called into a classroom to provide some information on one topic or another, or brought in to listen to a kid who wants to share some information with the officer. It really runs the gamut. A remarkably small portion of the time is spent enforcing the law.
I wanted to move, if that's all right.
One
we don't.
Question.
Well, I wanted to get to some of the community work around police.
I wonder if policemen, you know, in middle school, a lot of those kids look like grown men. And I think a lot of tragedies could have been avoided if the kids know more what to expect, if there's actual discussions about what to do if a policeman stops you. I wonder if either there is or is being worked on a curriculum, you know, role playing. It could be done very creatively.
Curriculum, I don't think there's any curriculum. Although that's an excellent suggestion. Certainly, officers have those kinds of discussions all the time with students. And in fact, our department has offered some of those throughout the community, geared towards young people. You can't do enough of them, though. And that's actually
and
a really good
suggestion.
Right.
In the community. Well, that's the next, that's our next question.
Yeah, it's a really good suggestion. I mean, a standardized curriculum makes a lot of sense.
Well, let's move from Emily's question into the relations of police and youth in the community, not just in the schools. And I think, you know, even a student handbook outlining the roles of various people in the schools and the resources that they can turn to, I think that's really an important suggestion, and the role of the SROs. Of course, I think they'd like to know the roles of their guidance counselors as well. So we ought to have a whole list of school personnel and have their descriptions and where to go for help, and it would hold school people, I think, more accountable. But we wanted to have the last part of the show really looking at police in the community and your whole concept of community policing. So one, again, is training around what Lori was talking about earlier, especially around de-escalation and not, you know, some of the instances we've seen around the country and how that can be avoided, how we're addressing the issue about racial profiling, including immigrants, and especially because of the federal law that has been using police departments and sheriff's department to identify undocumented residents. And then I'll go over it again if you missed it, but the role of the Police Advisory Board. We do not have a civilian review board. There was a coalition around that in the state trying to work, develop a civilian review board, so there'd be civilian police review board about having much more civilian authority. Nonetheless, Chapel Hill does have a Police Advisory Board, so if you could talk about that. And you know, how the police relate in the community. What are the various ways in which you try to have conversations both with youth in the schools and in the community, with our adult stakeholders, community organizations, and so on?
That was a lot.
And where to start?
Yeah.
Well, why don't we start with the young people? You know, what conversations you have with young people, to follow Emily's point, what conversations we have with some of the community organizations and adult residences. And then we can talk about the targeting.
Well, let me do a little bit just around youth relations. I mean, we're blessed in both Chapel Hill and Carver really with excellent, vibrant Parks and Rec programming and YMCA programming, and lots of opportunities where good youth programming is already underway, and we can participate in that rather than necessarily trying to reinvent our own program that might replicate what the experts are actually doing. So we look for opportunities to kind of organic opportunities to support activities at the Y and through Boomerang and through our Parks and Rec departments. We also are doing, you asked the question earlier about elementary schools, recognizing that in the Chapel Hill Carborough school system, we don't have SROs in the elementary schools, and there are opportunities there as a result of that. We've this year started also just spending time in our elementary schools and having our community services and community outreach officers making a pass through elementary schools pretty regularly. And that's to read to kids, to go in to have lunch, to seek an opportunity to come in and talk to a class here or there, just to begin some of that connection. And, you know, those organic opportunities for a kid to stop and ask a question like the one you were asking before, those happen really well through those kinds of settings. And those are happening about once a week. We also have a middle school young men's mentoring group. One of our officers has collaborated with one of our town human services employees for a long time now to mentor young men in the elementary, I'm sorry, in the middle schools. And they just, they talk about character building. They do some tutoring. They will coordinate college visits. And really just spend time together, building some rapport and helping these young men, you know, prepare for the next step in their education to move into the high schools. That's been, you know, ranging from, I'm sure I'll mess these numbers up, from 30 to 50 young men participating in that group for a number of years now.
That's interesting.
Yeah, and you know, it's not something that is... There's not some deliverable necessarily that we produce at the end of every year. It's just rapport building and relationship building and having some really strong role models. This officer, Kenny Lennon is his name. He's worked for us for 17 or 18 years. And John French, everybody in this community knows John French. He's worked for the town of Chapel Hill for many years, grew up in this community. Those two are doing remarkable work and have for a long time just through their presence and availability to young men in our community at a really formative age. And the young men who stick with that program generally get rewarded. We will, the town of Chapel Hill will fund a trip somewhere between 15 and 20 young people to go visit some historically black colleges and universities throughout the South, significant historic sites. Every year they take this amazing summer trip to include these young people who participated in this program. Something to be proud of and not something that we necessarily talk about.
Are you in all the middle schools?
Yes.
How are you invited?
I lied to you. The reason I lied is we moved around from different schools. This year, I believe the group is meeting at Smith, but
Smith
I don't want to give you the wrong information. I don't know that it's limited just to Smith kids. I don't believe that's true, but they do meet at Smith.
And
That's terrific. And you know, to even do more of that because it's so hard for so many kids these days to have strong, good male role models.
Well, this talks about how we collaborate because if we didn't know about it, many other people don't know about it either. And I think it's important to get on the school website or somewhere where really people can read this. I think it's worth a feature article.
Yeah.
I think the Elizabeth Friend at Chapel Newt would love to do a story about that. But I think it's and also I wanted to I wonder if you were working with Phoenix. Is it Phoenix Academy?
Phoenix
the
Academy.
One next to Lincoln Center. And because they have a wonderful, really principal who,
absolutely,
if you're not in there, I can't remember his name, but it's John something.
And there's not an SRO there now, but actually John and John French and Officer Lennon find their way into Phoenix and make connections there. So they're doing remarkable work.
I think the other question was whether you work with Lori Clark and maybe with the student MSAN and the...
Yes, we do.
And I can't remember what the other one, but there was some other wonderful core. Yeah. That's a core, you know, where these are student-generated programs. And, again, they would be important. That would be an important conversation. And I know, Lori, or you said Kenny or John French haven't been to some of her meetings, that would really have been terrific, but I'm sure they have.
They have. And we're always looking for opportunities for good, strong relationship building. And I think I would rather us do a few programs really well that are meaningful than do 20 programs and not be able to commit to them. This is what I just described for you, and again, I didn't do it justice. If John or Kenny were here, they would tell you a much better story than I did.
Tell them that they have an invitation.
Well, I will.
Yeah, because I think that's just so important for the community to hear these positive things, you know?
Right. Yeah, they will be very reluctant to come talk about themselves, but they can talk about the young people that they help.
Yeah.
That's fine. And to invite some of the young people, some of the young people who've been through this program. That would be great.
What
a great conversation.
And TV.
And TV. So the other story, the other part, and I don't want to, I won't have enough time for the body cam discussion,
yeah.
but
oh,
let's
yeah.
put that off for a while. So more about relations with other stakeholders. We talked about young people. And then if you could talk about the training that the police have been getting on trying to avert the racial profiling, whether it's people of color
yeah.
or it's immigrants,
sure.
And also to really de-escalate events where, similar to schools, where...
Yeah, this is, you know, we're all concerned when you look at all that's happening nationally and with the rise of people using their little cameras to take pictures. We've all been shocked at these tragic interactions with police and people in those various communities. And so that's what, you know, where we're coming from, like what's happening here, that in your training, I'm sure all policemen around the country are just saying, wow, you know, there really needs to be some different kinds of training than what's been going on, because obviously it's not been the best kind of training if you don't know how to de-escalate a situation. So we just want to bring that to Chapel Hill and your input.
Sure, sure. One thing I want to just say before we leave the topic of young people, and I don't want to make any promises about this because there are a lot of stakeholders involved in this discussion, but I've been really encouraged by conversations happening really throughout this county about juvenile diversion programs. You know, and we're one of only, I think, two states left now that treat 16 and 17-year-olds as adults.
Yep.
And that also contributes to some of our discussion earlier about school-to-prison pipeline. And I'm pleased to say that people in this county get that, and others get that too, but we're having really meaningful discussions in this county mm-hmm. about some diversionary programs to keep 16 and 17-year-olds out of the formal criminal justice system. Now, they're... You know, that's easier said than done, but I've been very encouraged by those discussions. I think it is responsive to much of what we've talked about.
Can you do diversion programs even though the state allows them to be treated as adults?
Sure.
Okay.
I mean, there's a great deal of discretion about who you charge and when you charge and how you charge. And
okay. Local prosecutors have a lot of discretion.
And so do the police.
And it doesn't – right. And you know, the spirit behind a program like that is not that you don't – there's no accountability. But there are lots of ways to correct behavior, and there are lots of ways to hold
yeah.
someone accountable that don't necessarily require a criminal charge. It doesn't mean that every single 16 or 17-year-old is eligible to be diverted, depending on the nature of the crime.
Right.
And again, this is conceptual discussion at this point, but I've been really encouraged by the discussion. And
you might want to talk to Lori Clark, who's working with Lilani Sangade and others, and about the Restorative Justice
Restorative
Project.
Justice, absolutely.
Yeah, they're really trying to get that institutionalized
right.
in the school, and
yes.
I think police support, SRO support, would really
right.
be very helpful. So the issue of training. And
yeah, so first off, I want to say this. We can always do better, but I am very proud of the training we've done in Chapel Hill for many years. De-escalation is built into our training, it has been for a long time, and I think we'll probably get a chance to talk a little bit about our police social work unit.
Yes,
we
yes.
have,
bring that in.
Well, I just want to – I think this is an appropriate time to talk about the influence of having a full-time staff of social workers on a police staff. So in the mid-70s, the town of Chapel Hill created a crisis unit made up of master's-level social workers and placed them in the police department. It's been part of our normal business ever since then to have social workers integrated into our work. So you respond to a particularly traumatic scene and you need some tools on your tool belt other than just what a police officer can bring. I mean, some immediate response to someone's emotional trauma, some resource referral, some ongoing case management. I mean, the array of options that these folks bring to a situation is remarkable.
How many social workers do you have?
Four.
That's wonderful.
Four.
That's
and hope to add one this year.
That's
wonderful. So 35, 37 years that program's been in existence here in Chapel Hill. It seems like a no-brainer, right? it's amazing to me still how few agencies have something like that in place. So we're blessed to have that, and I'm appreciative that our community sees that as important enough to continue to fund. And I talk about those folks because they influence the way we think about policing, and they bring an array of skills to our problem solving. And I'm not suggesting that a department without social workers is any less effective at de-escalating. I will just say that it's in our DNA in Chapel Hill, because from the minute we hire an officer and start our training curriculum, our social workers are part of that. And their availability and accessibility is something that our officers know from the very beginning. And, you know, having someone who understands your work but who provides a slightly different perspective on it, always with you, helps you think differently about your work. That doesn't mean that if you have a deadly force situation for which there is no other option, that you don't have the capability to deal with that. But when there are opportunities to de-escalate, to problem solve, I think our ability to do that is enhanced by having the culture established that we have established for many years of having those folks in our building. I hope that makes sense.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
As a retired social worker, it makes a lot of sense.
Oh, they're worth their weight in gold. And I will say this, too. You know, we take customer service very seriously. But I will tell you, in Chapel Hill, there are 39,000 911 calls are made every year.
How many?
38 or 39,000.
Wow.
That's in the ballpark. Right. So think about that now. A relatively small number of those are probably a police call, but it's somebody that needs something.
That's right.
And so we go to a lot of calls for service when there's just not a law and order remedy.
Yeah.
But someone needs something. They need a referral. They need some case management. They might need somebody to talk to. They need connection to some service.
Well, we're talking now also about mental health issues.
Well, exactly.
All right. Have you broken that out? Because that's a really very important conversation to have in the community as to how the police are brought into a variety of situations of stress.
Sure.
You know, it doesn't mean to break into a house, but either mental health or family stress or somebody having a heart attack, not just mental health, but an immediate need.
I would love to come back and bring our social work supervisor, because she's got data that will blow your mind.
Michelle,
Michelle Guarino, and she's fantastic, and she can speak about that.
I know,
but as you said, I mean, those cases are increasing in number, and it's not always a police.
That's right.
You don't always need to apply a cop to that problem.
No.
Right.
So we're really fortunate to have those folks. And then I'll just say one more thing about training. We invested a few years ago in a really expensive piece of equipment that allows us to simulate a variety of scenarios. We have this, I don't remember how much it was, $60,000 piece of equipment that projects video scenarios onto a screen that takes up a whole wall of a room in our building, and you can interact with that screen. And depending on what you do, the video will change and react to you. So we use it to train on de-escalation. We use it to train on decision making, because if you say and do the right things, you can diffuse the situation. If you say provocative things, the situation can escalate, and then the officer has to make decisions about, do they take some action that's now unavoidable? Do they, you know, what do you do? And it's a really impressive tool that gets employees in the mindset of, you know, what am I doing in this situation that's going to make it better or worse?
It's sort of like safe role playing.
Absolutely.
Which is terrific.
Well, and the other really neat feature about it is it captures the interaction on video. So then you can sit down, you can watch it, you can talk about it, you can say, what could we have done differently here? Mm-hmm. Or this was very effective, so we should remember that. And I'm pleased to say most of the time it's the latter example, but there are times you can make a mistake in that setting and nobody gets hurt. But you can learn a whole lot.
So police are engaged in this conversation, so their input into how, in a safe space where they might be able to do things differently or de-escalate, or what kind of resources might I need to do the kind of job that I really want to do and do it better in the community.
Great piece of equipment.
I think you wanted to talk about the body cam.
Yeah, there is a question of the body cam or personal monitor, whatever the term is, and the fact that it is, among other things, important to respect the victim's right to privacy under the Fourth Amendment. On the other hand, it's very important for it to be available to law enforcement and to the general public.
Yeah.
And how is that being handled?
Not very well. it's the best answer.
I guess I'm glad I asked.
Yeah, well, I think...
Well, there's debate about it, too.
Yeah, there's just lots of spirited discussion about that topic. You know, as I was saying before we came in, the technology has outpaced the policy. So I will tell you that I don't think you'll find many law enforcement leaders who don't think body cameras are the greatest thing ever. And I think communities agree. So I don't think that is up for debate. And I feel confident that one day, probably sooner than later, everybody will have them and the policy will have shaken out and legislation will have shaken out. But right now it's a little unclear. And agencies are thinking about how legislation that speaks to personnel law might apply, how legislation that applies to release of public information might apply. And that's just depends on who you ask as to exactly what applies and where. There were a number of bills kicked around this last legislative session in Raleigh that sought to bring some clarity to the body camera question. None of those passed. So the question is unresolved. I know as I've talked to police chief colleagues of mine, there's conflict around the question of accessibility of the information. I think fundamentally, just about every police leader says we understand the transparency interest, and you have images captured of a situation. Certainly, your community wants to see that. The challenge is it can be argued and has been argued that that data may also contain investigative information that you don't want to have public because it could be an ongoing investigation, or personnel-related information because one of your employees is captured on that video doing something that we might have to discipline him or her mm-hmm. for. I'm not offering those as arguments. I'm offering them simply as challenges that still have to be resolved mm-hmm. before this is clear.
I mean, I wonder with all the different issues that, in terms of policy that come up, is the Department of Justice at the federal level, are they developing like some model policies, knowing that each locality may want to tinker and make it theirs? But is that happening at the federal level?
I think there's some best practices that are being suggested, but you know, as long as state laws vary.
Let you know, there's only 2 minutes left.
Okay, so this is one of those issues. You know, maybe by the next time you have me back, maybe we will have resolved this question. But it remains to be seen.
I just, you know, we're ready to end our program here. I want to thank Chief Chris Blue so much for coming. But I think as we talk and have this conversation, we can see that there's follow-up visits that we would love to have with your social workers, with your other people doing great things, and you. So this is just an opening conversation that we are just tickled pink to have with you. And I just want to let you all know that please tune in next week. We're talking about the importance of voting, which starts tomorrow, early voting. And we are going to have somebody from Democracy North Carolina, and that's something that they work extremely hard on and are very knowledgeable about. We're going to have, we hope anyhow, Quentin Harper from Democracy North Carolina. So tune in next week. This is Lori Hoyt. We had Chief Chris Blue. We had Miriam Thompson, one of our Wolf sisters, Dick Paddock co-host, and Emily O'Hare doing the camera. And tune in Thursday nights at 10 o'clock, please. And you'll see some of our previous radio shows.
On the People's
Channel. On the People's Channel, Channel 8 in Chapel Hill, Channel 4 in Carrboro. And goodbye, and God bless, and we'll see you next week.
Don't forget also that at the top of the hour we have Chris Fitzsimon.
Yes.
Giving his weekly news and views.
It's just half an hour, and it's a terrific show.
Yeah, it's a very, very
almost as good
thing.
As ours, Dick. Almost as good as
almost
us.
Almost as good. Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Well, thank you all very much. Tune in next week, and
yes.
We'll be with you.
We'll be with you.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.